From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cardinal Bernard Law's legacy in Boston. The disgraced former head of the Boston Archdiocese is dead at 86. Survivors of clergy sex abuse respond.
Good riddance to bad rubbish. I hope the gates of hell are swinging wide to allow him entrance. That's what I think. I won't shed a tear for him. I might shed a tear for everyone who's been a victim.
Also today, the House approves a sweeping tax overhaul and the GOP is celebrating.
This is going to grow the economy. It's going to increase paychecks. It's going to increase take-home pay. And that, I believe, is going to be very popular.
We'll get the view from a member of the Massachusetts delegation on how the tax changes could affect this state. Plus, outgoing Williams College President Adam Falk on his legacy and the future of higher ed. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Pope Francis will preside over funeral services for Cardinal Bernard Law, the former head of the Boston Archdiocese at the peak of the clergy sex abuse crisis. Law died yesterday. He was 86 and will be buried in Rome. Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley wrote in a statement that, quote, "As Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Law served at a time when the church failed seriously in its responsibilities and with tragic outcomes failed to care for the children of our parish communities," end quote. Law was Archbishop of Boston for 19 years. He resigned following the Boston Globe's stunning series of reports in January 2002 that revealed how the church knowingly moved abusive priests from parish to parish under Law's tenure. Here's Bernard Law on January 9, 2002, his first public press conference following the Spotlight team's reports.
Pray that those responsible may come to conversion of heart and self-awareness. Pray for the hundreds of faithful priests of this archdiocese who bear with me the burden of a few. Before God, we are trying to do the best we can. And in your kindness, pray also for me.
Bernard Law announced his resignation almost a year later. He decamped to Rome, leaving the Boston Archdiocese facing 500 lawsuits and more than $100 million in damage claims. We're going to hear from a number of voices and perspectives about their reaction to Bernard Law's passing today. We're going to begin with James Carroll. He is a historian, a scholar, and an award-winning author of many books, including Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. James Carroll, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Meghna. My pleasure.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Walter Robinson. He's editor-at-large for the Boston Globe and a member of the Spotlight team that covered the clergy sex abuse crisis that broke that story back in 2002. Walter Robinson, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Meghna.
So, James Carroll, let me start with you. For members of Boston's Catholic community, what is the impact of this moment now that Cardinal Law has died?
Well, it reminds us in a very painful way the scale and scope of the moral collapse of the Catholic Church, because it wasn't just that thousands of priests harmed tens of thousands of young people. The priests, after all, were a small minority of those serving the church in the period, but that effectively every bishop worldwide protected the abusive priests instead of the children. Hmm. The failure was not just a failure of a relatively small number of diabolically misguided clergy. It was the failure of the vast institution of the clerical culture itself. The bishops protected the priests because they were protecting the structure of a misogynist power structure. And Cardinal Law, and then, of course, Cardinal Law's rescue by the Vatican,
right,
is the great symbol of that. The failure of the bishops and the failure, I would say, to this day of the Catholic hierarchy to reckon with what was laid bare.
Yeah. Walter Robinson, in a sense, we all knew this moment was coming, right? I mean, Bernard Law was 86. But yesterday's announcement and today's sort of thinking again about the legacy he left behind must be ripping open wounds for the many, many people who suffered at the hands of members of the clergy, is it not?
Well, it certainly has. It certainly will continue as long as the church resists efforts to get it to change its way. My hope is that we can look at this death as a milestone, and look at the cardinal, as Jim mentioned, as one of a generation of leaders of the church who, like their predecessors, had a first and only priority of protecting the reputation of the clergy at the expense of the children. Hmm. And to think that those of us who grew up and whose values came from our Catholic upbringing were exposed to this, what was an international criminal conspiracy, where the gap between good and evil was so wide and so deep, and all the evil rested with the church.
Walter, let me just jump in here and ask you, because I want to play a moment from, again, that January 2002 press conference that Cardinal Law gave following the first couple of Spotlight reports. It's the one we played a little tape from earlier when he was begging everyone to pray for him. In the question and answer portion of that press conference, you were there and you asked a question of him. You said, will the church continue to issue secrecy orders around other pending cases regarding accused priests? Because, of course, this was a major part of the problem, that the church was deliberately keeping these cases secret. And you said, will they continue to do that? And here's how Law, honestly, it looked like he wanted to burn a laser through you the way he was looking at you. But here's how he responded.
You know, I have to tell you, Mr. Robinson, that my focus has been on preparing this statement and this case. And I need to just leave it at that.
Take us back to that moment. I mean, I think that was a very telling moment about how he was handling this cataclysm that was going on in the Archdiocese.
Yeah, and he handled it so badly. He talked in that press conference, as you played earlier, he talked about all the good priests having to shoulder, quote, the burden of a few. And in fact, as we learned much later, the few were more than 10% of all the priests who served in the Boston Archdiocese over 60 years, which is an extraordinary number. He also said in that press conference that there is not at this moment any priest serving who has abused children. And we already knew and were preparing reports on a fairly large number whom he had sent back to parishes knowingly, even though they had serious records of abuse of children.
Yeah. James Carroll, respond to that.
Well, I want to just emphasize that the story here isn't just Cardinal Law. It's the ongoing structure of the Catholic hierarchy. Because don't forget, at the bottom of his disgrace, this man was promoted to one of the most prestigious positions in Catholicism, right, as the archpriest of the Basilica of St. Mary Major in Rome.
I mean, he was drawn even deeper into the fold for the
Vatican. Well, he was being rewarded, of course, for doing what the bishops were depending on him to do, which was to protect the
church,
secret of
yeah.
Catholic power. And the equivalent today would be as if Harvey Weinstein were given a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Academy Awards ceremony next March. That's unthinkable. The scale of disgrace and shock and anguish that we're going through now with the revelations of the ways in which women are abused routinely in culture, the only previous moment that this can be compared to was the ongoing revelations of the abuse of children by Catholic clergy. And that disgrace was not reckoned with at the highest levels of the church. Cardinal Law is going to be laid to rest tomorrow with the full panoply of honors due a prince of the church.
At St. Peter's.
At St. Peter's, with the final blessing pronounced by Pope Francis. This this problem has not yet been reckoned with.
So let me just ask you about that. And Walter, I'm going to ask you the same question here in just a second. But Jim Carroll, help us understand, because I think that that very fact is, has come as quite a shock to people, because here we are 15 years later. We now know, for years now, we know that this was a worldwide crisis. And yet the Pope shall be presiding over Law's funeral. I mean, is that the church saying that it still privileges tradition over all? I mean, wouldn't this be an opportunity for Francis to step back and say no?
Of course, it's a missed opportunity. Pope Francis has been eloquent in denouncing the scandal of Catholic clericalism. He has yet to begin to dismantle the structures of Catholic clericalism, which, of course, essentially boil down to an all-male system that, by definition, denigrates women as second-class citizens. And as long as that is at the center of the Catholic organization, sexualized power will continue to be a festering abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. So Cardinal Law is a crime. His behavior was a criminal, but he's also the evidence of something that is yet to be reckoned with. The bishops are going to surround the remains of Cardinal Law tomorrow, and in effect, they're going to thank him for having been not just their scapegoat, the one who took the heat for them, but also their hero, the one who went to his death having never, ever fully reckoned with what he did.
Walter Robinson, what do you think about that? Because on the one hand, the church says that it's enacted many a reform around this crisis. But here, as Jim Carroll points out, the bishops are going to look at Pope Francis overseeing a funeral as evidence that they are continued to be protected.
Yeah. Well, I think many of us think of the church, even under Pope Francis, of trying to move slowly from the late 17th into the early 18th century. And it is not true that the church has dealt in any responsible way with the abuse. I mean, the reforms that have happened in the United States, many of them have happened at the point of a gun, with district attorneys overseeing the church. I will tell you that last year I spoke at a journalism conference in Brazil, and we had in Boston 2 million Catholics and 250 priests who abused children. Brazil is the most Catholic country of the world. It has 130 million Catholics, and to date, only about a dozen priests have been named as abusers. The state is unwilling to take a look, the church is unwilling to make change, and the journalists, quite frankly, are too frightened to go looking.
Huh. Walter Robinson, just take us back again for a moment, if you can, to the 2002-2001, the period around which the Spotlight team was reporting on this story, before those first stories came out. I mean, did you have a chance to interact with Cardinal Law? What was he like then? I mean, just remind us of him in that moment and the tension around what you were trying to uncover.
Well, we did not deal directly with him at all. One of the most telling sentences at the very top of the very first story we did said that the Archdiocese said that it did not even want to know what questions the Globe had on this issue. And the Cardinal's first press conference, which you played portions of, was riddled with inaccuracies, including the statement that two medical practitioners had certified Father Gagan to return to his parish. So in other words, it wasn't my fault. Mm. And in fact, as we reported 2 days later, those two physicians were his family general practitioner and a psychiatrist at St. Elizabeth's who had himself been accused of molesting his own patients. And that was the attitude that the Cardinal had. Tell the truth never, only when forced under oath, and even then, tell it sparingly. And we had, a situation in this Commonwealth, and I'm going a little bit out on a limb here, but we had an attorney general who could have indicted at least one of Law's minions, Bishop McCormick. And we had a federal grand jury which, on a perjury charge, could have indicted the Cardinal himself for certifying under oath that one of his priests going to a VA hospital had no problems in his background. And in no case were charges ever brought. I mean, the number of bishops and cardinals who enabled this kind of behavior by priests for decades, the number who have actually suffered consequences is tiny.
So, Walter Robinson, it sounds as if this isn't the end of anything, but perhaps just the turning of a page in this story of the church and abuse.
Well, there's no substantive change until the church makes fundamental change, as Jim has noted. One issue about law returning to Rome in 2002, this was, to us, the tell that he was given this position of prominence because he took a bullet for everybody else, because virtually all the other cardinals that we know of, including St. John Paul II when he was Archbishop of Warsaw, engaged in the same practices of moving priests from one parish to another, always with the goal of protecting the reputation of the church at the expense of the children.
Mm-hmm. Well, Walter Robinson is editor-at-large for the Boston Globe. He was head of the Spotlight team when its reporting about the clergy sex abuse crisis came out in 2002. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Walter. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
I want to bring in another voice here, that of a survivor, Phil Saviano. He's founder of the New England chapter of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Phil, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
So what was your reaction when you heard that Cardinal Law had died yesterday?
Well, my initial reaction was, what's the phrase, good riddance to bad rubbish? But to be honest, I initially thought that his passing would sort of ease the anger and the anxiety that so many survivors have felt towards this man for so many years. And what I've discovered instead is it's just sort of stirred everybody up and brought back a lot of bad memories. And I just think that in some ways, you know, the stories, the bad feelings never really come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was thinking about is that old saying, be judged by the company you keep. And I'm bringing up the word judged because this is the judgment day for people who believe in that, for Cardinal Law. And he was a guy who had such possibility, was so highly regarded, highly respected, so powerful when he was the Archbishop here in the 80s and in the 90s. And there was so much good that he could have done. But for whatever reason, he made the decision that he was going to keep company with the, under his direction, roughly 40 or so child molesting priests, and put the children of the Archdiocese at risk. So he took the side of these priests as opposed to taking the side of the parishioners and the children.
So, Phil, can I just jump in here?
Yeah.
I mean, we've been talking about the symbolism or the meaning of
right.
the fact that you know, Pope Francis will be presiding over Law's funeral at
yeah.
St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what you think of that.
Well, I didn't realize that until 5 minutes ago when you were talking about it, and I find it astonishing that's happening, that the Pope doesn't know what sort of a message he's sending to the rest of the world. I mean, maybe it's more important to send that message to his bishops. But I can tell you that there's going to be a lot of fallout, particularly from Catholics who care about this issue and certainly from survivors. I think it's a really bad move. I think it's a nervy mood. And I just think it's appalling and very, very surprising.
Yeah. Have you spoken with, you know, other members of SNAP or other survivors today?
Yes, I have. And I mentioned that, you know, my initial thought was that, well, maybe this will ease some of the anger and help people to be able to move beyond, but that's not at all the case. I've had a lot of very angry comments posted on my Facebook page, and I spoke to several at a press conference earlier today, and all his passing has done is brought back, like I said, a lot of bad memories and renewed the feelings of anger and betrayal that so many of us have felt.
Well, Phil Saviano is founder of the New England chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Magna.
Jim Carroll, let me spend the last couple of minutes with you because you said something a little earlier which is really weighing heavily on me, and that is no matter how many, I'm paraphrasing here, no matter how much effort or how many different changes the church has said or even put into place in the past 15 years, that there are some core aspects of Catholicism and its leadership that mean that this problem, regardless of the likes of cardinal law, is not going to go away anytime soon.
No, something very deep has to be dealt with here. I'll draw an analogy. After the Holocaust, it became very clear to Christians that Christian anti-Judaism had spawned Nazi anti-Semitism, which required the Christian church, led by the Catholic Church, in fact, during the Second Vatican Council, to begin to dismantle the theological structures of anti-Semitism. And that's been happening. And it's the most important change in the history of the Catholic Church. Something analogous to that has to happen in relationship to misogynist clericalism, a big manifestation of which was this abuse of children, of vulnerable people, by clergy. And obviously we're talking about very deep attitudes toward sexuality, toward gender, toward the relations between men and women, toward the relationships of adults to children. Some very basic structures of the imagination have to be addressed. It seems like an insurmountable project.
It does.
But it isn't. And the dismantling of structures of anti-Judaism are an example, a case in point. Look, if after 2,000 years the Catholic Church can say no more saying the Jews murdered Jesus, which is what the Church says now, a change at that level can happen in relationship to the teachings on sexual morality and the relationships between men and women, the relationships between adults and children, and so forth. The crisis in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein revelations, again, is analogous, not equivalent, but analogous. Basic structures of the imagination are being laid bare as being kind of deeply, deeply inhuman and cruel. And those structures have to be adjusted. That's what we're talking about here.
So let's talk about how deep those structures do run, even within, or perhaps especially within the Boston Archdiocese here, as we find it today. Because on the one hand, you know, looking at the statement that Cardinal O'Malley had put out upon Cardinal Law's passing, as I read a little earlier, Cardinal O'Malley acknowledged that as Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Law served at a time when the church failed, seriously. He says that in his statement. But then he also says, this is O'Malley's statement, it is a sad reality that for many, Cardinal Law's life and ministry is identified with one overwhelming reality, the crisis of sexual abuse by priests, because his pastoral legacy has many other dimensions as well.
Well, those other dimensions count for nothing when they're measured against the damage he did as the enabler-in-chief of rapist priests. So we shouldn't mince words about that. Cardinal O'Malley is a man of profound goodwill. He's demonstrated that quite powerfully in his years as the Archbishop of Boston. But he, too, is refusing to carry this reckoning to the level to which it must be carried, which is basic structures of church power, because that's what at bottom was at stake in this crisis. The reason the bishops protected those abusive priests was not that they were indifferent to the cruelties and crimes of their abuse. It was that those crimes and cruelties did not weigh as much for those bishops as the structure of power.
Right.
And that's still at work. That's still at work. And of course, the simplest, first, and most obvious issue facing the Catholic Church in this context is the ordination of women to the priesthood. Hello, women are not priests because Jesus did not choose any women to be among the 12. Jesus didn't choose any Africans to be among the 12 either. Yeah. If the Catholic Church forbid the admission of black people into the priesthood, what would the world make of that? That's an exact moral equivalence to the Church's position on women in the priesthood. It's an institutionalized declaration that women are second-class citizens. Women don't count as much as men. It's male supremacy, sanctified, blessed, willed by God. It's completely wrong, and the sex abuse crisis shows how dangerous it can be.
Mm-hmm. You know, John Allen, one of the best reporters on the Catholic Church, was writing about cardinal law, you know, the entirety of his life, where he was born, his rise within the church hierarchy, the crisis, and then, as we were speaking about earlier, how the Vatican pulled it into the heart, pulled him into the heart of the Vatican following the crisis. But looking overall at that, John Allen had written that that law was a titan of late 20th century American Catholicism. So if that's the case, James Carroll, just last question, where are American Catholics to look for the titan that they need for the 21st century, for this other vision of Catholicism that you bring to the table?
Well, we see it in Pope Francis, the fact that he has a very large blind spot on this very question, that he's still protecting the clerical establishment against the revelations that have been so blatantly clear about it, shows how far we have to go. But Pope Francis has begun something and has begun a level of change in the Catholic imagination, for example, on the meaning of sin, on the meaning of conscience, on the primacy of conscience. He has begun something and demonstrated the change at this very deep level is possible. My hope is that in the years that remain to Pope Francis, perhaps even reckoning with the legacy of cardinal law, he will carry this much more further in this realm of the relationship between power, sexuality, and the equality of men and women. But Pope Francis shows it can be done. The most powerful reason for Catholic hope is that year in and year out, actually week in and week out, millions of Roman Catholics, knowing full well the sin of which the hierarchy of the church is guilty, still find it possible to defend this church and to call for its reform. And every Catholic who worships begins the act of worship with an act of repentance, because we all acknowledge a certain complicity in this crime.
Yeah.
And the Catholic people themselves are the reason to be hopeful for the future of the Catholic Church. And I would just add very quickly that the Catholic Church is the center of rational religion. It's the center of self-critical religion. That's what the tradition of the Church at its best has represented. And at a time when irrational religion, intolerant, uncriticized religion, threatens the future of the human species needs a reformed, democratic, powerfully committed to the equality of all people, Catholic Church. And that's what's at stake. This crisis has been a profound wake-up call to the Church. And the wake-up call is still being heard. It's not finished yet.
You know, I hear your cri de coeur there, but I can't get past the fact that the very man we're talking about, in terms of Pope Francis, still chooses to preside over the funeral services of law under the dome of St. Peter himself. I mean, That is not the self-reflective Catholic Church that you're talking about right now.
No, that's true. The Church, you know, the Church speaks of itself as the body of Christ. The body of Christ is grievously wounded here. Phil reminds us that those bleeding the most still are the survivors of the abusive priests. But all of the Catholic people are bleeding. If I didn't believe in those people and the capacity of those people to demand change, then I too would have left this institution behind. Pope Francis is not finished. Pope Francis too is a human being with limits defined by his own experience, by his own generation, by his own life as a man living in a celibate clerical culture. But he has again and again shown the capacity to transcend his own limits. He's not finished, and the people who succeed him aren't finished either.
Well, let's hope, definitely. James Carroll, historian, scholar, award-winning author of many, many books, including Christ Actually, The Son of God for the Secular Age. My deepest thanks for you coming in today.
My privilege. Thank you.
And for everyone listening who's been touched by this crisis, go to RadioBoston.org if you want. Share your story, or you can also send us a tweet, as always, at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Washington today, in a strict party line vote, the House passed the GOP's massive tax overhaul. And again, it was a strict party line vote, so not one Democrat voted in favor of the bill. Republicans say that the new tax plan is for everyone and that it cuts taxes for everyone, though the biggest breaks do go to the wealthiest. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan earlier today praising GOP efforts.
This is one of the most important pieces of legislation that Congress has passed in decades to help the American worker, to help grow the American economy.
Well, joining us now from Washington is Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Congressman Capuano, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
Are you sure about that?
Well, it's good to be back with you. It's not a great day to be in Washington for me.
All right. So tell me what you think. I mean, after the Senate did its work the other night, it seemed inevitable that this was going to happen today in the House. And so it's happened.
Yeah, we all knew it was going to pass. So, and by the way, this was a bipartisan bill in the sense that we had 12 Republicans who voted against the bill with all Democrats. So America is already caught up on this. They know this is a tax scam. They know that everybody will probably get a few dollars for a few years. That's about it. The big money is going to people who don't need it and won't use it to benefit America. And by the way, I represent a lot of wealthy people in my district. I haven't had any of them tell me anything other than the fact that they don't think this is good for America. So I don't like this rich versus poor thing. This is people who have a knowledge and an interest in what's good for business and what's good for America. Versus those who are just greedy. And that's what this bill is. It's just a way to scam America. And they didn't get away with it, except they did win. But America is caught up to them.
So let me ask you something, Congressman. This actually has more to do with how the bill passed the Senate the other day. But it seemed as if, at least on the Senate side for a long time, it was going to be really, really close until at the last second, Susan Collins, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, a bunch of key votes flipped and said yes. I mean, did that come as a surprise to you guys in the House as you were watching what was going on there?
Honestly, no, not really.
Really? Okay.
Especially some of the ones that were involved. We've had dealings with them in the past, and we know that some of them, they talk a big game, and on occasion they will show up with the courage of their convictions, but more often than not, they'll cave in and toe the party line. And I understand that. I mean, look, politics is a team sport. I get that. And sometimes you have to take one for the team, but sometimes you really have to stand up for your constituents, and if the team effort is bad for your constituents, you need to say that. That did not happen in this bill.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape from President Trump just a couple of moments ago. He celebrated the bill's passage through the House with GOP legislators at the White House.
I guess it's very simple. When you think you haven't heard this expression, but we are making America great again. You haven't heard that, have you?
Congressman Capuano, there are a lot of Americans out there who are quite supportive of this bill. I mean, what would you say to them?
They're mistaken. I mean, the people, look, as long as you know that this is about getting rid of the government, the people understand. The Speaker Ryan has already said that his next target is now to get on the spending side to entitlements. Entitlements are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and veterans benefits. Those are the so-called entitlements. I don't think of them that way, but that's the term. And if the speaker has already said that, where else do you think that they're going to go to make cuts in spending in order to address the massive deficit that we have and that they just made massively worse? There are no economists who think this bill will generate enough new economy, a bigger economy, to pay for itself. It's going to cost us a minimum of $1.5 trillion. Everybody agrees on that number. And everybody agrees that it will provide possibly, at best, about a half a trillion dollars in economic benefit, leaving at least a $1 trillion hole. Where do you think they're going to come up with that money?
Mm-hmm.
And my argument is very simple. You will see in the very near future they will come for spending cuts on the programs that most Americans have come to take.
Well, Paul Ryan has already more than hinted at that, right? I mean, yeah. that could be right on the docket come January when the House comes back.
Very much so. They're not going to change their spots. I mean, they change the arguments they make, but they are not going to change the belief they have had since the 1930s that Social Security was a bad program. Since the day it was passed, they've hated Medicare and Medicaid. These are not new positions. They just don't couch it that way anymore. They now couch it as, oh, we're going to reform them. Reform these programs means hurting people, and it means weakening the future for the people who aren't on them yet but will someday want to have Social Security and Medicare. And I think that, again, we'll find out in the very near future, but the Speaker has said it. And he's a good man. He's a man of his word. He just happens to be dead wrong.
So, Congressman, let me ask you, I mean, to that point, looking forward to 2018, when the issue of Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, does come up, given the fact that this tax bill, as controversial as it was, as, you know, badly polled as it was polling, as, you know, people were protesting on Capitol Hill against it, and it still got through. What hope do you have? What hope do Democrats have, or anyone who doesn't want major changes to Social Security and Medicare, have to stopping that in 2018?
We'll find out. I mean, a lot of people, I think, made a political mistake when they analogized this fight to the fight of health care. The health care battle that we had, that we won, was all about taking something away from a lot of people and giving the rest of the people nothing. So just taking away. This bill is a tax cut bill. There's always going to be somebody who thinks they're getting something. And even the people who know that they're not getting anything, they still want the little crumbs that we're going to get. So it was a different thing. When we get into Medicare and Social Security, I think America will rise up again and speak out loudly, number one. Number two, every day that clicks away, especially after the first of the year, is a campaign season. And I will dare my Republican friends to go back to campaign in their hometowns telling people that they're trying to cut Social Security and Medicare.
No, they're going to go back and say, we gave you a tax cut.
Well, good luck to them. And if they can win that, you know, so be it. I just don't think that, again, back to the polling, and again, every poll, I'm not a real believer in polls per se, but every poll shows overwhelmingly the American people oppose it. Now, I don't know that many people go to the polls and vote against somebody because they voted for this bill, just on that item alone. But if this bill is then followed up by another bill and another bill and another bill that they don't like, you add on top of that they didn't like their attempt to repeal the health care. Young people don't like what they just did on net neutrality. You're going to have a whole series of things that the American people don't like. And, again, I think most people do tend to vote in what they see is in their long-term best interest, and I think they'll do that. But we'll find out. That's what elections are all about.
Well, Congressman Michael Capuano represents Massachusetts 7th. It's really great to speak with you, Congressman. And
speaking with you.
Happy holidays.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. At the end of this month, the president of Williams College will step down to take the helm of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Adam Falk has led Williams since 2010, during which time the school has grown its endowment by more than $1 billion, now topping $2.5 billion for a campus of about 2,000 students. And that's students, I should say, and that's obviously not the only thing that's changed during his tenure. And joining us now from Williamstown is President Adam Falk. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And so first of all, let me just ask you, I'm going to ask you about endowments in a second here, but tell us a little bit more about your decision to step down now. Eight years is long, but not that long.
8 years is kind of average for a college president, and I had a wonderful opportunity to lead the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which is really a great foundation that supports science and economics and the public understanding of science and economics. So it has a research mission and an educational mission, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to join that remarkable institution.
Okay, so that good enough reason for me. I just wanted to check to be sure there wasn't a story behind the story there. So let's talk about for a second, since in the last segment we were talking with Congressman Michael Capuano about the tax overhaul, which passed the House, because there are aspects of it which will have an impact on a lot of key colleges and universities in Massachusetts. And I just want to ask you specifically about the endowment excise tax. That looks like if President Trump, which he will, signs the bill, is going to happen. It's going to impose a 1.4% tax on investment incomes from schools with large endowments, which Williams is one of them. So what impact might this have on Williams?
Well, I think it's significant. And I think this is unprecedented to tax the endowment earnings of operating foundations. So it's historically one is taxed the endowment earnings of the foundations like the Sloan Foundation that make grants to other institutions. And those were taxes that were meant to give the IRS the resources necessary to monitor whether those institutions were actually making philanthropic contributions in the way they should. But hospitals and museums, colleges and universities had never had their endowment earnings taxed because we spend those earnings on our mission. And our mission is educating students. One of the reasons that we're so fortunate is that we have an endowment of the size that we do that allows us to run the college not on tuition revenue primarily, but primarily on endowment earnings.
Uh-huh.
And that means that, you know, as more than half of our students don't pay the full tuition that is on our website. Even people who do have their at least a third of their education is actually paid for by the earnings from the endowment. We have more than 20% of our students are on Pell Grants. About 20% of them are first-generation college students. All of that is possible because our economic model relies on endowment payout, endowment earnings, rather than primarily on tuition to run the college. And so to tax that in those earnings is to directly impact the education that we're able to provide to all of those students.
Well, since you brought up tuition, I mean, the cost of higher education, the cost of a college education keeps ratcheting up and up and up faster than the pace of inflation. I think we were looking at some numbers, and all told, you know, if a person hadn't been receiving any kind of assistance from Williams or loans, going to Williams would cost something like $70,000 a year. Okay, that's everything together. I mean, what can we do to make it more affordable?
Well, I think that the if at the beginning of your sentence is the important one. That is, the only people who actually pay $70,000 a year are those who are fortunate enough to be able to afford that. And we ask families to pay only what they can afford. And again, most of our families receive some kind of financial aid. And so what they pay is unrelated to that $70,000. They pay what the financial aid analysis indicates their family can afford. I'd point out that although college tuitions are going up and college fees are going up faster than the overall rate of inflation, income inequality in our country is growing. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the rate of income growth in that part of our society that can afford $70,000, the rate of inflation for them, the rate of income growth for them is larger than the rate of the increase in our comprehensive fee. So for the families that can afford it, it's not getting harder to afford. And for the families that can't, it doesn't matter what our comprehensive fee is because our financial aid program means that they only pay what they can afford in real terms.
Yeah. You know, college campuses have long been the nexus of so many pressing issues that the country faces. And this is, you know, since time immemorial, but definitely now as well. So I've got a couple questions about big issues that college presidents have been facing. For example, in the area of adjudication of sexual assault, campus sexual assault. Now, you set up an extremely aggressive goal of zero sexual assaults on campus at Williams. I mean, how realistic is that goal? And how close have you come to achieving that?
Well, I don't think there's any other goal that's an ethical, moral goal to have. And we have that goal because, you know, it's simply unacceptable to have people in on our campus who are subject to violence, just as I'm sure it's our goal in the country that there should be no violent crime, even if we know that in our country there is violent crime and we have to deal with that. But I think to set out that marker is to say, to make a moral statement about the behavior we expect of our students and the safety that we expect that our students ought to be able to expect when they come to the campus. I would say that the most important piece of this is not the adjudication, it's the prevention and the education efforts. And we've invested deeply in those. And those are really investments in the nature of our community and getting students to care for each other, to take responsibility for each other, to not only check their own behavior, but to check their behavior as a community. And I think we are seeing progress in that. I wish I could say that we don't have incidents of sexual assault on our campus. There's no college president who can say that truthfully. But we're not going to stop working on this issue until we get there.
Okay, so what about the issue then, moving on to another hot button one, of free speech on college campuses? I mean, you've come under some criticism for a February 2016 decision to deny a controversial speaker an in speaking engagement on campus. I mean, lots of people think that college campuses, liberal arts college campuses, to say the least, have become places of intolerance when it comes to controversial speech.
Yeah, I think that sells our students really short. I mean, I think it's a great headline that somebody at Middlebury was shouted off the stage or something happened here or there. But the fact is, you're going to find more robust and thoughtful and respectful discussion of difficult issues on our college campuses than practically anywhere else in our society. Certainly more than you're going to find it on television news shows, certainly more than you're going to find it in the halls of Congress. So, you know, I'm proud of the work that our students do to engage across differences. You know, to run a college campus is not exactly the same as a town square. And we don't have the obligation to invite absolutely anyone to say absolutely anything to absolutely anyone on our campuses. I didn't like to not allow this particular speaker to speak 2 years ago. This was someone whose writing was so explicitly racist that he had been fired by the National Review. I didn't think that he added anything in terms of intelligent discourse about difficult issues. He was simply coming to provoke our students and say outrageous things. And I didn't think it added to exactly that goal that's so important to us, which is serious conversation about serious issues.
So let me just ask you a quick question there before we run out too much time. I was I like your phrasing about town squares and college campuses. Now, you're saying that a college campus shouldn't exactly be like a town square, but I'm wondering, maybe it should. Maybe college campuses are exactly the place right now, given the polarization of America, that should try to model themselves as the town square or town squares in which civil discourse can occur, even between the most incendiary positions.
Right. So, and I think that I agree with that. I think that the college campuses should be exactly those places. But that requires work on the part of the community to create environments in which those conversations can take place. So how does that happen at a place like Williams? We invite speakers who have different points of view to debate each other and engage with each other. We have on our campus as a visiting professor right now, Chris Gibson, who's a Republican representative from the state of New York, recently retired. And, you know, our goal is to bring him into conversation with people with other points of view, with more liberal folks. But to do that in a way that, you know, that the program is one that is thoughtful and respectful, and students have a chance to ask questions thoughtfully and respectfully. Mm. You know, that's not the same as saying that, you know, a Richard Spencer can just come onto any college campus and shout racist invective. That doesn't move forward that goal, which is so important, of creating the kinds of town squares that you're talking about.
Well, we have just about a minute to go here. And last question, since this is something of an exit interview with you, what are you going to miss most about being president at Williams?
I'm going to miss the students. I've been in higher education ever since I went to college without stop. And to be around young people, you know, 18 to 22 years old is a great privilege. You know, young people are complicated. Every one of us was complicated when we were that age. But they are the future of our country. They are the future of our world. They have enormous potential, and to do the work of working with them to help them realize that potential for their own good, for good of the country, is one of the great, wonderful things you can do in your professional life. And I'm going to miss our students enormously.
Well, Adam Falk is the outgoing president of Williams College in Williamstown. He steps down at the end of this month. President Falk, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.